It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The federal agency that enforces worker safety protections announced in recent months a move away from traditional hard hats. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration says its inspectors now wear safety helmets at inspection sites. We learn about the evolution of traditional hard hats into modern safety helmets and changes at an Appleton-based construction firm. Call in with the question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Kristen Clements is Safety Operations Manager at the Bolt Company. Kristen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
And Will Cummings is here, journeyman, iron worker, and weld shop foreman at Bolt. Will, welcome.
Good morning.
Will, let's start with you. Hard hats have been made from a variety of materials over the decades, canvas, metal, fiberglass. Modern hard hats made of plastic. What are the main differences between traditional hard hats and these new safety helmets?
Well, with the new safety helmets, they come with a chin strap, and that's kind of a big deal because most incidents, let's say, like with the traditional hard hats, if you were to fall, let's say, from a ladder, 90% of the time your hard hat, the traditional hard hat, would fall off. With these newer hard hats, with the chin straps, the hard hat should stay attached. So that's a pretty big deal safety-wise.
Yes. I also understand that these helmets have like foam in the helmet, like a high-density foam. Is that to like absorb impact?
Yeah, they're much more shock-resistant than the traditional hard hats. A lot of the traditional hard hats don't have any foam in them. But these new ones have that new shock resistance.
So, Kristen, a couple years ago, Bolt transitions from the use of older hard hats to these new safety helmets. How are these safety helmets changing the way that workers at Bolt do their jobs?
Yeah, I think it was a big change from a tradition and culture standpoint, especially even just the look of them. But really, I guess for us at the end of the day, it was about providing the best protection for our employees. So we never experienced a traumatic brain injury, previously. And I guess by going to the helmets, we feel much more comfortable if something were to happen, if somebody were to have a fall, even if it were just from a ladder, that our employees are much more protected.
How do you get workers who have been wearing a traditional safety hat, a traditional hard hat for decades, to feel comfortable and embrace a new design of protective equipment?
Well, to say it would be easy would probably be a stretch, because it has been such a big tradition for such a long time. But really, I think, when we took the approach, it was trialing and piloting a lot of different styles of the safety helmets on projects, and really trying to work with the employees as much as possible, getting out to job sites and getting their feedback. And that was really a big part of this journey, was working with the employees, working with our project teams, and just finding out what the struggles and the obstacles that they're having, because we have many different types of trades that do a lot of different scopes of work. So there's a lot of things to take into consideration, especially when it came to, regions where we have high heat, or facilities that we have, maybe dripping or chemicals or stuff that could be falling through, was a big determiner, made a big decision on whether we were going to go with vented or non-vented. And for us, there was a point where we actually, we started with non-vented helmets, but because of some of those high heat regions, we said, no, the feedback we were getting, we had to go with vented options.
What would venting look like on a safety helmet?
Well, there's several different styles. Some of the venting is off to the side. And some of the helmets that we have now currently has just like the venting on top, kind of like what a bike helmet, like the venting of a bike helmet looks like.
Oh, sure. Uh-huh. Yeah. You know, in terms, Will, do these safety helmets, do they obstruct hearing at all? Or are the ear, what happens around the ears?
No, they don't obstruct hearing at all. And actually, they come with, I believe they have, Kristen, I believe they have like attachments where you can put earmuffs right on them and then just slide them down.
We're talking about worker safety in construction with the Bolt Company. It's based in Appleton. Will Cummings is here, journeyman, iron worker, and weld shop foreman. Kristen Clements is safety operations manager. Call in with questions and comments about safety gear. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Will, you made me think about how these safety helmets have the ability to put on a bunch of different attachments, it seems. Was that possible with a traditional hard hat before?
It was, yeah. We had, you know, face shield attachments, welding helmet attachments that would clip right over the old traditional helmets. So there was actually, that was probably the biggest challenge when we switched was figuring out how the new attachments would work. And when it first got launched, Kristen came to me and I got to try out two different types of helmets, all different types of attachments, kind of gave her my feedback. Things weren't working at first, you know, helmets were too close to the face. They weren't far enough away. And Kristen and her team did an excellent job working with us. And we came up with a solution to all those problems. And right now, you just clip your face shield on. You hit two little buttons on the side of your hard hat with these brackets. And, you can switch out your shields in an instant.
Kristen, what was that like for you trying to make all of these attachments work and work properly in so many different types of settings?
Yeah, I think that was, definitely a lot of trial and error. And it was pretty interesting coming into this journey because we weren't the first company that's gone to helmets. And there were several different types of manufacturers out there that had helmets, but they didn't have a lot of accessories, especially when it came to welding. And just because of the profile and the shape of the helmet compared to the hard hat, the traditional accessories that were working for a hard hat weren't necessarily working for the helmets. It was leaving gaps or, as Will said, too close to the face if they were welding, not necessarily be able to put a respirator underneath and things like that. So that was really where we were able to take that feedback and try and work with any manufacturers we could that would, listen to our feedback and just say, hey, this is some of the problems that we're having, as far as the fit, but then also being able to, switch back and forth. If we have somebody that's doing hot work and they're welding and they're grinding and going back and forth, being able to switch back and forth to the proper accessory multiple times a day, it's been a challenge for sure.
Will, I have the vision of a welder in my head and just the importance of having those shields there in that hot work, as Kristen said. Are the risks different in working in a weld shop than as a journeyman iron worker?
I would say it's probably more convenient to work in a weld shop compared to working out in the field.
What do you mean by that?
Well, first of all, the elements that you're in. I'm in a 70 degree year round heated shop. Mm. And out in the field, you're in all the elements. So that's number one. Number two is there was kind of two different helmets that we were experimenting with. One of them wasn't vented. One of them is vented. And with the vented one, being a welder, always grinding, welding, sparks flying, we have to make sure that we're wearing a cap underneath our helmet because there is the risk times of getting sparks down those vent holes. So that's kind of a big deal too.
Will Cummings is a journeyman iron worker and weld shop foreman at the Bolt Company. Kristen Clements is with us, the construction company's safety operations manager, as we discuss safety gear on the job and the transition to safety helmets. Call in with a question. You can share your comments along the way at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The hard-boiled hat, also called the skull bucket, revolutionized the safety product industry a century ago. That's history from Smithsonian Magazine. We learn about advancements in protecting workers from head injuries and the shift away from traditional hard hats to safety helmets that aim to provide better protection to side impacts and front impacts. Call in with a question. You can add comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Will Cummings is here, journeyman iron worker at the Bolt Company. Kristen Clements is its safety operations manager. Kristen, it was interesting to me that Bolt did its own research on safety helmets and then made sure that your manufacturer that you chose would incorporate your findings in the design. Why was that critical?
The biggest part of it was that the feedback that we had for the manufacturers was coming from the employees. And being as big of a change as this was, we didn't want to just roll something out and say, here, kind of do safety to the employees. It was more about, and still is, about trying to work with them to find out what works for them. So having manufacturers that were willing to listen and take the feedback and actually start making modifications and changes to their designs and even come up and create new equipment and work with their design teams was a pretty big factor. In the direction that we've gone so far with the helmets that we're using and the accessories.
So Milwaukee Tool becomes the manufacturer of these helmets. How did this partnership come together?
It was just kind of organic in a way through the trialing, and we worked with several just different, like I said, different manufacturers. And it was really the ones that were willing to listen and really take the feedback and ask questions, be willing to come even to the field, come to our offices, and just be there and be present, was a really big factor in that.
Will, did you feel that open communication about how to improve these helmets and make them just right for the work that you do?
Absolutely. Like I can't say enough about our safety team, at Bolt, with how they did work with us, and take our feedback. Like, it's a big deal. These guys got to wear these hard hats, every day. And change is always a tough thing in construction. I mean, years ago, from switching to different harnesses, everything presents a challenge when you change it, to these guys that they got to wear it every day.
Have you seen a head injury before in your career, Will?
I have not. I have not. I've been close myself. I fell off a ladder once. But I did not get hurt. But my hard hat did fall off.
What did that incident, did you change after that? Or was that like a warning for you about the importance of protective equipment?
Well, this happened, probably 10, 12 years ago. So, I guess we didn't really have the option to change. And
yeah,
at that time.
Kristen, how does Bolt care for its workers if they sustain injuries or, a head injury on the job?
I mean, if we were to have, any injury, not just even a head injury, but at the end of the day, these are our employees, our people, and we want them to go home, you know, in the same shape and condition they came in with. So taking care of our employees is always a big deal.
What are the cost differences between the old hard hats versus what these new safety helmets cost?
I would say you're probably ranging anywhere from, you could range probably $50 to $80 more per helmet with the new helmets, depending on the helmet that you go with.
Is that due to their design or their materials or something else?
Yeah, I would say it's probably a lot to do with the design and the materials that go into it, just because the traditional hard hat is really, you know, the shell, whether it's a plastic or fiber metal, and then it just only has the suspension on the inside. Now you're adding besides the plastic and the design of it, now you're adding in that integrated foam, the chin straps. So there's definitely a lot more materials. And there's also a lot of the helmets are really going towards the type 2. So then that means you're getting different ANSI certifications and testing that comes along with it to give it the impact resistance when you start talking about the side and the front and the rear, and not just the protection from like a something falling or an object falling from above.
It makes me think about how OSHA has also changed its helmets. Do you think your helmets will eventually become more of a standard out in the field on construction sites and in the industry?
Absolutely. I think within the next, I don't know, 2 to 3 years, I think that it's going to be pretty much the norm. You know, I've just in the last 2 years, I would say even in the last year, we've seen a lot of companies switching, and even, you know, other companies throughout even just the Fox Valley are switching to that. You know, it's just, I don't know, at the end of the day, it's the right thing to do. If we have a better opportunity and equipment to protect the people that are in the front lines every day, then that's just the right thing to do.
We're discussing worker safety with the Bolt Company in Appleton. We have Kristen Clements, its Safety Operations Manager, and Will Cummings is here, journeyman, iron worker, and weld shop foreman. Call in with questions and comments about safety gear and hard hats, the transformation, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Will, how else can worker safety efforts improve? What are the next steps?
I think that's a better question for Kristen. I mean, we, as workers, we're going to do what we have to do to come to work every day. And to me, at the end of the day, I want to go home to my family safely.
Mm-hmm.
So with Bolt Safety Team, bringing up new ideas, and they're willing to work with us on everything, as long as we know that we're coming to a safe place to work, which is, I mean, Bolt cares about their employees and their families. And that's what's important to me.
Kristen, is there other personal protective equipment, you know, going through a similar major design and safety overhaul?
Maybe not necessarily. I can think of like new right now, but I mean, you know, a couple of years ago we had switched from, or not switched, we went to ANSI cut level 4 gloves or higher on our job sites, where and 100% glove use. So regardless of what you're doing on site, even if you're just a project manager walking out onto the site, because who knows, maybe you quick go to grab something, we require everybody to wear gloves. You know, and we saw a big reduction in our hand injuries just by going to 100% hand protection and a higher cut level than, you know, requiring a higher cut level than we ever have before. So it's just some little things like that, you know, that's making a difference.
It seems like that might be a small difference to have that level of protection for the hands, but if you can see that, you can see the difference pretty instantaneously, like with a change like that in safety, that can make quite the difference, I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, just I guess the technologies that are changing. I mean, it's no different than going from your iPhone, Apple, 10 to a 14, I guess, and all the different features, where you have a cut level 4 glove now, or even cut level 5s and 6s that have a lot more dexterity to them. So it's not like you're wearing a big padded mittens trying to do your job when you need to have the dexterity. So now you have, gloves that are, allow for the dexterity. So it's just advancing, the technologies and stuff that's out there.
Well, Kristen and Will, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Will Cummings, journeyman iron worker, weld shop foreman at the Bolt Company, Kristen Clements, safety operations manager at Bolt. And for disclosure, the Bolt Company is a WPR business sponsor. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. There are new uses on the horizon for soybeans, including as a firefighting foam. We talk with the Wisconsin Soybean Marketing Board about soy-based possibilities. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about someone reflecting on the pivotal moments in their life. It's part of a series we're airing this month on women in southern Wisconsin in partnership with Midwest Mujeres.
Samantha Green of Madison has a philosophy she lives by.
My motto for life is nothing is impossible. It's just a matter of figuring out. All you have to do is keep at it, and before you know it, it will become your reality.
Green says thinking forward has helped her move past the roadblocks in her life. The mother of 3, grandmother of 6, told me about this as part of a storytelling partnership with Midwest Mujeres in Madison.
I didn't start with the best start, but I had a mother that taught me that can't is not part of my vocabulary, and I can do whatever I choose to do. I do realize that sometimes I get down on myself, but I never give up. At one point in my life, I was a drug dealer and realized God and I required more of myself.
Green was about to turn 30, and she knew something was off. She wasn't even excited for her birthday.
So I had this talk with God, and I was like, I know I'm not living out my purpose that you set for me, and I need some help to get to that. And a month after that, I got arrested. And every step of the process, he showed up and made me realize, like, I'm answering this prayer. And people just started showing up.
People from her past, people from church, people from every corner of her life. Green says her community's support, paired with her self-determination, led to a pivotal moment. She went back to school.
Ever since I was little, I knew I was going to graduate from college. I knew I was going to have this career. I knew I was going to talk for a living, and I knew I was going to help people. I knew I felt it.
And she did it. Green graduated by the time she turned 40. Since then, she's worked in jobs helping people. Currently, she's a program leader with Dane County Department of Human Services. And when she's not working, you'll often find her outside.
So I've always fished. I've lived here in Madison since I was about 4 or 5 years old, over at Brittingham. Like, my grandfather lived there. We used to cross that bridge over there and go over there and fish. Like, we would have fish fries at the lake.
And during the pandemic, Green tried something new outside. She went camping for the first time.
And I fell in love. So the more I went camping and the more I realized, like, sitting around the campfire was a different feeling. And the people that you share the campfire with is healing. The stories, the conversations that you have, like, it does something for your soul. People are really who they are without the stresses of the world. We don't have to put on any faces at the fire. Like, we're all equal at this point. Our jobs don't matter, nothing matters, and it's just you with these real life questions, and you're answering them. And it's soul searching, and it's also getting answers.
Now, Green wants to share that love of camping with others.
I want my own camping resort, Black-owned camping resort, where, of course, it's gonna make money because people camp all the time, but also to offer teaching kids how to fish. teaching going through the trails, teaching how to start fires, teaching how to cook outside on an open fire.
She sees a real need for it in Wisconsin.
Because we're Black and brown people, it hasn't always been the best experience to be outside, and especially in woods. And I go camping up north 2.5 hours away. It's not always the best thing to be outside. But I haven't ran into any negative experiences. And I also look at everything as a teacher moment. People of different colors are learning about me. I'm learning about them. And at the end of the day, we're all the same.
Green is the type of person who's energized by change. She's at a point in her life when she's embracing challenges rather than pushing them away.
Life is really short. And no matter what, like, you have to honor that inner voice within you.
Samantha Green shared her story with us as part of a partnership with Midwest Mujeres in Madison. We've partnered with the organization to share stories of women who live in southern Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Toxic forever chemicals known as PFAS have been used for decades in certain firefighting foam and are polluting water supplies. Now, a biodegradable soy-based foam is under development, free of PFAS. We explore new and emerging uses for soybeans. Call in with a question. Add comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Pat Malouli is president of the Wisconsin Soybean Marketing Board and a soybean farmer with about 2,400 acres in Clinton. Pat, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
So you were in Georgia to review a project studying the feasibility of soybean-based firefighting foam. What did you find out?
Yeah, so it was kind of a neat trip. We had the opportunity to go down to Dalton, Georgia, where Cross Plains Solutions is based. And they've been working with the United Soybean Board on a project for the last 18 months to produce a firefighting foam and get it to market. So we were able to go down and get through the plant and see how they're utilizing soy flour to get into that product. And then we were able to go to a training center where they demoed the use of it on real fire. So got to see it full circle here this week.
How did it perform? How did it do on a real fire?
So the firefighters that were there, some of them were soybean farmers from around the Midwest. When we get in them rural areas, you had soybean farmers / volunteer firefighters, and they were able to get right in the mix and spray it on the fire themselves. They were very excited about it. It's something that is needed as the PFAS products have been banned in some states. So it looked good to me. I'm not a firefighter, but it did what they said it was supposed to do. The other thing that happens is it's hard to rekindle those fires when at those training centers, they tried to reuse those sites and those products that burn and they couldn't get them going again. So that was kind of what brought that all to their attention.
Yes, because there are Class A, Class B fires. So how does soy foam compare to other firefighting foam that contains the toxic chemicals, PFAS?
So the product, from what I've been told by those firefighters there, the training center firefighters, that it performs just as well, and they don't have the risk to the firefighters, risk to the environment with the PFAS-type products. So this is very biodegradable. Once water is added to it, it breaks down in a hurry, and there's not the exposure risk as those other products that are on the market or been pulled from the market recently.
What might be the input here for soybeans in a soy foam product? Like how much soybeans do you need to turn that into a firefighting foam?
So they're using soy flour, which I had never seen. We have soy meal here, soybean meal that is fed to livestock, but this is more finely ground.
Okay.
And with the right emulsifiers in there that the chemist was – that invented it, it looked like a pail of paint. That's the consistency of paint. It was a brown type substance, maybe a little bit thicker than soap, but it was in 5 gallon containers, the 55 gallon jugs to 250 gallon totes. And they just inject that into the water stream and it creates foam. Is kind of how it works, what we saw anyways.
The State Soybean Marketing Board is funding the soy foam project with its checkoff program. Can you explain what this program does?
Yeah, so for every bushel of soybeans that's sold in the state of Wisconsin, 0.5% of that value is taken out. It's called the grain assessment, and checkoff dollars is pulled out from that farmer's check that he receives for those beans. And the half of those funds stay in the state of Wisconsin, and we're an seven-man board. We're elected by our district, so I'm in the district in South Central Wisconsin, representing in my area, and we have six more of those. So a seven-man board, and we meet 4 or 5 times a year to discuss how we invest those dollars back to new uses, research and development of new technologies at the University of Wisconsin. We have a strong program of research for disease and weed control and things like that, or new ways to grow soybeans. And then the other half of those dollars goes to United Soybean Board, which is a national level, and we have representatives in the state of Wisconsin that represent farmers at a national level as well.
It's just amazing how many uses there are for soybeans. Can you give us a little bit of a taste through, like, the more common and maybe some uses we don't even realize?
Recently, Goodyear Tire, there's some soy oil that in Goodyear Tires, Skechers Shoes. I think Crayons have been soy-based. That's just to name a few. And then now the soy foam and the reason we were in Georgia, the other thing, the backing on AstroTurf and carpeting, Dalton, Georgia is the world headquarters for AstroTurf, and they're using the soy oil in their polyurethane, they explained it to me, in the backing for AstroTurf and carpet.
I wonder what the outlook is like for soy-based foam mattresses and some of these other uses of soy foam. What do you see happening there?
It's a great possibility. We also, while we were in Georgia, we met with the carpet folks and the AstroTurf folks, and they're trying to continue to add the bio-based type products and pull out the longer-lasting chemicals that might be in there. So the really endless opportunities when you get the right people on the job, like happened with the soy foam here.
Pat Malouli heads up the Wisconsin Soybean Marketing Board, is a soybean farmer in Rock County. Be part of the discussion about uses for soybeans. Call in with a question. You can add your thoughts at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin is home to about 14,000 soybean growers that count from the State Agriculture Department. We learn about new markets for soy-based products, and you can be part of the conversation. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Pat Malouli is a soybean farmer in southern Wisconsin, president of the Wisconsin Soybean Marketing Board. Pat, you know, I made a tofu stir fry last night for dinner just for you. I had you on my mind. What other projects is the marketing board prioritizing this year?
Good question. So a big part of our budget goes to the University of Wisconsin Extension, and we have a strong university extension up there in the research department with Sean Conley heads up the soybean extension. Rodrigo Worley is a weed scientist, and Damon Smith, a pathologist. And those folks have a great research department. They're great with extension, getting the word out to farmers on what's new and what's changing. And with that, we leverage some dollars back from other states because that program is so strong. Switch gears a little bit. We're investing in a project where we go out into or hire people to go out into tech schools to teach younger diesel mechanic students on the benefits of biodiesel and how that all looks going forward. We also, the Port of Milwaukee, we've invested into some projects there to really renew that ag products flowing out of the Great Lakes Basin, St. Lawrence Seaway, is just to name a few that we're working on.
I want to go back to that first one with the crops themselves. I mean, farmers have issues with runoff. They need ways to protect topsoil with cover crops. How do soybeans affect those challenges?
Great question. We're working on a project, and it's kind of an integrated look at soybean production with Sean and Rodrigo and Damon, how cover cropping, as you had mentioned, is the climate smart practices coming into role, and how does soybean production still get maximized using those types of initiatives. So that's a big project that those folks are collaborating on, and those cover crops and the climate smart practices are great, but also as a farmer, we really need to make sure that we're staying profitable, and it does get a bit challenging. Those cover crops and things add more management back into your system, and they're great for the soil, but can cause problems as we learn about them in our own operations.
How resilient are soybeans in a changing climate?
Soybeans are a very resilient crop. They can handle thinner stands, and they bush out early, but again, to maximize yield, we need to do our due diligence to make sure they get off to a good start, and the cover crops can hamper that, especially in Wisconsin, where we stay a little bit colder sometimes than late April and May. But we on our own farm have seen the great benefits from them, but also have had some challenges, but the benefits outweigh those challenges in our farm.
Because, you know, you are in the thick of it as a soybean farmer. Are the number of soybean farms growing or shrinking in Wisconsin?
Great question. I don't have the exact numbers, but we see a lot of younger folks that have a tie to the farm getting back into it. And granted, maybe the last 3 years we had great commodity prices, and those are kind of in a slump right now. So we'll see how many young people continue to get in, but I think just in our area, we've seen more young folks getting into farming and taking advantage of those opportunities.
Do you have access to high quality soybean seeds to plant fields?
Yes, that's not an issue for us. It may be in other parts of the Midwest, but we always have a ample supply of good quality seed.
So, you know, moving soybean products and the harvest out of, like, the ports, you know, we're seeing the State Board reporting that Rock County is a top producer of soybeans in Wisconsin, and the city of Evansville has potentially a $700 million soybean processing facility in the works. What is the status of that project?
Yeah, just checked into that here a little bit earlier this week. They're waiting on an air permit through the DNR, which just takes time. There's no issues with it, but it takes time. There's been a lot of studies as far as soil borings going on out there. It looks like if it happens, they'll vote here, the CHS board, in June. So that could be underway construction yet this year. And that proposed to be a 70 million bushel plant, and that is 2/3 of what we grow in the state of Wisconsin. That's kind of a big deal if that happens for us.
So that way you could get those soybeans much more quickly processed and to different markets?
Correct. That would be the primary product coming out of there. Two primary products would be soy oil, and that would be for cooking oil, and then also the soy meal. And that's kind of where, you know, we hope the Port of Milwaukee would help with that shipping of the soy meal over to new markets that we haven't been in before is the hope or what we see coming.
We're discussing soybeans with Pat Malooly, president of the Wisconsin Soybean Marketing Board. Call in with a question. You can share your comments at 800-642-1234. Pat, we heard from Kelly in Oshkosh, called in with a question, is wondering, with the plans to create soy foam and other soybean-based products, Kelly is concerned about the environmental impact of the infrastructure required to make products sustainable, and is wondering, how is the board planning to grow the industry and protect the environment at the same time?
So, great question. As far as the soy foam that we saw, it had one of the first ratings. It's called a green screen certification for safer chemicals, and it had the gold labeling, and it is the only product for firefighting foam that got the gold rating. So that's things that I think us and the folks that we're partnering with to make these products are very aware of. So we will continue to make sure that it's safe for the environment as we move forward with these new products.
Do you find that in order to create these products, you have to really, you know, perhaps scale up soybean fields? Are soybean pests difficult to control?
I would say yes to that. They are getting more difficult to control, especially weeds. We have herbicide-resistant weeds that we're dealing with, but that's where growers are experimenting with cover crops. As you bring cover crops into your crop rotation, it helps keep those weeds in check. And that's kind of back to some of that research that we invested with up to the University of Wisconsin with Sean and Rodrigo and Damon up there to see what new tactics will work better for us to maybe eliminate some herbicides or those herbicides that aren't working. We have other options to keep our fields clean.
Mm-hmm. Would you find in our closing moments here that soybeans are going through some sort of renaissance, or, you know, seeing new possibilities for the soybean crop? Or has it always been a crop that has been finding new ways of use?
I think it's always been a crop to find new ways, no different than corn. But you never want to turn your back on any idea with it as technology continues to get better. And we have no different than the soy foam. I was able to talk with the inventor of that and just the idea. And he made it a point to get this to market. I knew I could make soy foam up. You know, how do we utilize it? So I never want to turn your back on an idea because it could always come to fruition and be the next best thing.
Pat, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Pat Malooly is president of the Wisconsin Soybean Marketing Board and a soybean farmer with about 2,400 acres in the southernmost region of our state. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Hundreds of thousands of people of Latino descent make a life in Wisconsin. We explore connections between faith, hospitality, and social justice movements in Latino communities through the decades and those implications today. Call in with a question. You can share comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sergio Gonzalez is an assistant professor in the Department of History at Marquette University. New book is called Strangers No Longer, Latino Belonging and Faith in 20th Century Wisconsin. Sergio, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me, Kate.
Your family immigrates from Jalisco, Mexico, to the U.S. before you are born. And this book, you start researching Latino history in a library. Can you tell us what happens when you open those boxes of archives?
Yeah, you know, like any young graduate student, I had grand ambitions to go into the archives and kind of uncover the history that was central to my dissertation when I was in grad school. And for me, the topic I was most interested in was really discovering the history of Latinos in the state of Wisconsin. I went to the archives for the first trip and, you know, with great ambitions and asked the archivist to bring me everything that they had preserved on the history of this community that I thought was going to take up the next few years of my life to study. He came back with three boxes and told me that was all that they had. It was pretty disheartening at first, but I opened that first box and the very first document that I pulled out was a newspaper insert from 1987 from the Milwaukee Journal. And on the front cover of that newspaper article was a picture of my family and me, just a few months old in my parents' arms, walking out of a Southside church here in Milwaukee. And I got to thinking as I looked at that image, what did it mean that the Milwaukee Journal had featured this Latino family walking out of a church on a bright Sunday morning, happy, in fellowship and community, and was kind of showcasing this image as distinctive, but also very indicative of the history and the story of Latinos in Milwaukee and across the state of Wisconsin.
In that moment, you must have had so many emotions going through you and so many questions.
No, absolutely. It's that existential moment that I think every historian, every scholar is looking for when they ask themselves, you know, why am I studying what I study? And here I was on my first trip to the archives, literally finding myself within my research. And so it was very stupefying, kind of that first experience. And then I had to kind of quickly put on my historian's hat and get to work and kind of untangle all of the things that this document could tell us about the present, about Latinos in Wisconsin in 1987, and the past. What was the history that this image could kind of unveil for us?
You must have had so many gaps to fill, to tell a story of a community whose history, resides in several boxes at that archive. But you also said it's a history that's been ignored. So how do you begin to tell the story?
Yeah, you know, for me, the kernel, the nugget of this project is really seeking to understand why it is that even though Latinos have existed, have occupied, have lived in spaces across the state of Wisconsin, they're often still referred to as newcomers, as foreigners, as aliens, as people who don't fully belong in the state. And I think this introduction story about the archives is kind of just one way of digging into that, right? If we don't think these people are permanent residents of the state, if we don't think that they deserve to belong in the state, why should we preserve their history? And so my research, both in this book and in other endeavors that I have as a public historian, are really trying to understand, why is it that Latinos have come to Wisconsin? Why haven't we done a good job of saving that history? And then I think most importantly, what do we have to do moving forward to make sure that we can do a better job of archiving those histories, of preserving them, of celebrating them, so that we can better understand this past as well.
Sergio Gonzalez with us, author of the new book, Strangers No Longer, as we talk about the history of Latinos in Wisconsin. Call in with a question. Share comments at 800-642-1234. Sergio, let's step back for a moment, go back a century, talk about the migration of Latinos to Wisconsin throughout the early 1900s. Can you talk about which Latinos are migrating to Wisconsin, what it is like, and why they are coming?
Yeah, so the first Latinos that we can recognize as really settling here in Wisconsin stretch back to the late 19th century. But the first sizable communities that we can kind of see developing, especially here in Milwaukee, begin in the early 1920s. And they're recruited here to the city by the city's growing factories, foundries, and tanneries, to serve kind of as the next group of cheap, pliable labor. They're really following, unfortunately, in the footsteps of a lot of different immigrants who had come before them, who had kind of filled these really difficult positions, working in backbreaking labor that often did not compensate them well. And kind of to complicate that, to make it even worse, when they were recruited from Mexico in the early 1920s, they were often brought as strike breakers to break the heavily unionized workforce here in Milwaukee. And they were brought, of course, under false pretenses. They didn't know that's why they were coming here. So their first interactions with the city are some pretty rough ones, right? They they have some pretty awful experiences at the work site and social spaces. They're not really accepted as Milwaukeeans, as Wisconsinites when they first arrive. And As I detail in the early sections of the book, those early Mexican immigrants who come to Wisconsin find fellowship, find a sense of sanctuary, a sense of belonging in their churches. And it's also one of the only places that they develop any sort of community with the city's white European American residents. It's that shared sense of Catholicism, a shared sense of faith that allows them to create bridges of fellowship. And they're often tenuous bridges, right? They're not the strongest connections because they don't always extend beyond the confines of the church, the pews in which they're praying together. But there's something, it's something to look into and to try to understand how can this faith serve as a bridge between these communities that may have otherwise seen themselves as enemies or antagonists.
I was struck by how these early immigrants were at sometimes living on factory floors in Milwaukee, and the living conditions were so poor and not being able to find housing. But at the same token, you are trying to build out the story of how churches were sometimes a place of refuge, sometimes filling those gaps. But can you talk a bit about these living conditions at the time?
Yeah, you know, they are shuttled into Walker's Point, which the historian, Milwaukee historian John Goethe, has often referred to as Walker's Point as kind of the Ellis Island of Milwaukee. It's the entry point for a lot of immigrants who arrive in the city throughout the 19th and 20th century. It's one of the city's oldest neighborhoods. And it's also the place that was a hub for this factory, tannery, and foundry work that these Mexican immigrants are being brought to engage in the early 1920s. And so this is the only neighborhood that they can really live in for a number of different reasons. I mean, one, it's right next to their work sites. The housing there is in pretty rough shape. It's the only place they can rent. And often what happens is these Mexican migrants will show up and they might get a house. And then while the men are engaged in this hard physical labor, the women are also engaged in labor. And that's in the labor of kind of constructing these apartments, these settlement places where incoming Mexican immigrants can settle and find a place to lay their head. Because otherwise, as you note, some of them are forced to live within the factory walls, especially those initial immigrants who are afraid that if they leave the factory walls, they're going to get their heads bashed in by these Milwaukee workers who are quite upset with them because they're seen as strikebreakers, as scabs. And so their assimilation experiences are really tenuous here. The other thing that I'll note that I talk about in the book is that a lot of the social agencies that are ostensibly in place to help them integrate into the community, the immigrant settlement houses here in Milwaukee, see them not only as foreigners, as alien, but as racial others. And so drawing from eugenics and this kind of this pseudo-racial science, they perceive these Mexicans as not being fully capable of integration because of some racial deficits. And so they have a really rough go of it outside of churches, finding a place where they can belong in the city of Milwaukee.
Talking with author and historian Sergio Gonzalez, the book is Strangers No Longer, as we explore the intersections here of migration, fellowship, activism, and churches. Call in with a question. You can add your reflections. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the Latino community and its faith practices in Wisconsin, drawing upon migration, labor, the religious history. Marquette University historian Sergio Gonzalez probes the question, why are Latinos still viewed by many Wisconsinites as newcomers? Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. The book is called Strangers No Longer. Sergio, you write about a time of hostility toward Latinos in Milwaukee, but Mexicans do find some common ground with fellow Catholics. What was that relationship like between the newly arriving immigrants and the Catholic Church? And were there Spanish-speaking priests at the time?
Yeah, you know, it was it's a really interesting inflection point for Mexicans when they arrive here, because it takes them a while to really find a home in the Catholic Archdiocese here in Milwaukee. And it's really because of the initiative of some local Catholics just kind of at their local parish, at the Holy Trinity Church in the Walker's Point neighborhood. It kind of speaks to the importance of individual agency, of individual actors, of kind of taking that step to reach out to persons who may be different from them, who they may not recognize, but perhaps they see that they need some sort of assistance. And so there's this individual here at the Holy Trinity Church. His name is Frank Rose. And he is a loyal member of the congregation. He speaks Spanish because he's an accountant who works in Mexico sometimes. And he takes the personal initiative to rally the Holy Trinity Parish to help these arriving Mexican Catholics in the city of Milwaukee. And he takes it upon himself to reach out to the Archdiocese and to work with the Archbishop here in the city. And to the Archdiocese's credit, they commit funds to purchase a building on the city's south side where Mexicans can practice their faith. It's a mission chapel that they choose for themselves because they want to be able to practice their form of Catholicism in a way that's comfortable to them, that reminds them of home. And then, of course, they have to go through that arduous work of finding a priest who can actually speak Spanish, because this is a problem that exists all across the Midwest as Mexicans are arriving in places like Chicago, Detroit, and the Twin Cities. There aren't any Spanish-speaking priests who can really serve them. And so this is all happening in the midst of a very traumatic revolutionary war in Mexico. The Mexican state is coming down pretty hard on the Catholic Church. And so there are actually Mexican Catholic refugee priests all across the United States. And so this early mission chapel that they call Our Lady of Guadalupe Mexican Mission Chapel, they're able to recruit one of these refugee priest to come up to Milwaukee in 1926 and serve as the city's first Mexican pastor.
Does the church exist today?
Yeah, it certainly does. It's not in that original storefront building, although if you come down to Fifth and National in Walker's Point, you can certainly still see that building there. But the congregation has moved into the Holy Trinity Church, and Holy Trinity is one of the oldest Catholic churches in the city of Milwaukee. And it's a story that's replicated across, U.S. Northern Catholic churches all across the country. White flight in the 1950s and 1960s really brings down the white population, the white Catholic population on the city's south side. Holy Trinity Church is losing its kind of traditional parishioner base. But at the same time, the south side's Mexican and eventually Puerto Rican community and Catholic community is exploding. And so in the mid-1960s, the Mexican Mission Church migrates over to Holy Trinity and kind of takes it over. And to this day, Holy Trinity, Our Lady Guadalupe, is really the heart of Mexican Catholicism in Milwaukee, and I would argue really in the state of Wisconsin.
Sergio, you really dig deep into that Christian tenet of hospitality and study aspects of the hospitality at work here. How would you characterize at this point the extent of hospitality to these early arrivals of Latino immigrants in the 1900s?
You know, the reason I draw on this concept of hospitality is because I think it's something really, it's something that we all understand, whether we see it as a religious tenet or just something as a social value. And so when we look back into the early 20th century, we can kind of recognize the way in which communities do or do not welcome people, kind of see them at the threshold of a building or the threshold of a community and make the decision to open their doors to them. And so the thing that's really interesting about the 1920s and 1930s is that early Mexican mission chapel really goes all out in all types of ways to be hospitable to Mexican Catholics. It does so in a religious sense by offering them a religious home, and one that is connected to the larger Milwaukee Catholic Archdiocese. But that religious home also serves as a social service agency, as an educational space, as a political space, as Mexican Catholics in Milwaukee can kind of research and keep an eye on what's happening in their home country in terms of persecution of the Catholic Church in the 1920s. And so for me, one of the prime examples of what we refer to as kind of a full sense of hospitality really does happen in the 1920s. And it perhaps is kind of alarming to think about that 100 years ago, the city had some of the best instances of outreach to Mexican immigrants. And perhaps there are things that we can certainly learn from those experiences today in the 21st century.
Sergio Gonzalez with us, author of the new book, Strangers No Longer, as we take a look at the deeper history of Latinos in Wisconsin. Call in with questions. You can share your perspective at any point. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sergio, drawing to present moment here for a moment, in recent months, record numbers of migrants are attempting to cross the southern border. Are there parallels between the migrant experience and the hospitality you've been talking about a century ago versus what is happening today?
Oh, goodness. There certainly are. Some of them are startling. Some of them are perhaps fresh. But there are also distinctions that have to be made between these stories, right? I guess it's my job as a historian to kind of draw those parallels while also demarcating the things that are different. I think that the number one thing that we have to recognize is that the people who are arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border today are arriving for many of the same reasons that Latino immigrants began to arrive in places like Milwaukee in the early 1920s. And really, quite honestly, that most people have come to this country, and that is to search for a better life for themselves and for their family. Now, a lot of those people who arrive at the U.S.-Mexico border might or might not qualify for political asylum under U.S. and international human rights law. But the question of why they're coming, I think, is really important. And the second piece of that, of course, is what obligation the United States has to offer some sort of home, of solace, of sanctuary to these people. And that, of course, is one of the most active political conversations that we're having today. The thing that's interesting to me as a lifelong Wisconsinite, as someone who studies Latino communities here in the Midwest, of course, is how do we view this phenomenon that's happening 1,500 miles away at the U.S.-Mexico border is something that is important to us. And of course, I think we see this in different ways. We can see this in the way in which Latinos arrive in Wisconsin, not just in Milwaukee, not just in Madison, but really in all parts of our state. I think we just have to look at a place like Whitewater, which over the last 6 months, over the last year, has been grappling with this very question of hospitality and the also difficult question of how we can provide services to people who are really looking to make a life for themselves in this country. And these are not easy conversations. They're certainly not easy conversations when we only have them at the local level. And so that's why I think it's important for us to kind of blow the lens up and look at it from different stages, whether it's the local, the state, the federal, and of course the international as well, and to put it within that larger historical perspective.
I was trying to glean insights from your book about the operations of government in those moments that might inform what happens today. And you write about the Governor's Commission on Human Rights. And I'm just wondering, you found state commissions often working with employers, but seeing the migrants as more of like a problem to be solved. What were the dynamics there?
Yeah, I mean, this is a phenomenon of the post-World War II era, as a lot of local and state agencies are trying to grapple with the United States' obligation to live up to its stated ideals of democracy and citizenship. And so, of course, after soldiers returned home from fighting overseas in World War II, there are a lot of Americans who kind of are rethinking how they can best exemplify those stated ideals, those progressive ideals of democracy and citizenship. And so when Texas Mexican migrant farm workers begin arriving in large numbers in Wisconsin in the 1940s and 1950s, they unfortunately experienced a lot of similar situations that Mexican immigrants had experienced in the 1920s here in Milwaukee. And now, of course, it's not just happening in urban spaces like Milwaukee, but it's happening in places like Wautoma, in Door County, in Waupun, all across the state. And these commissions, like the Governor's Commission on Human Rights, they see their work as twofold. One is to try to draw out the best in Wisconsinites to fulfill some sort of larger obligation to protect and preserve this concept of human rights. But there's also kind of the harder part, which is how do you get people to do that work? Mm. And the thing about those state agencies is that they really held no sort of power. And so there was no enforcement capacity to push Wisconsinites to treat Texas Mexican migrant farm workers as more than just laborers, to treat them as human beings, and perhaps also as constitutive members.
Let's pause there with Marquette University Assistant Professor of History, Sergio Gonzalez. Call in questions, 800-642-1234. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A book that centers Latinos in Wisconsin shows how immigrants mobilized through their religion and how churches can serve as agents of political change. Be part of the conversation. Call in with a question. You can share your views, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sergio Gonzalez is an assistant professor in the Department of History at Marquette University. Book is called Strangers No Longer. Sergio, we heard from Rachel, sent along an email saying that they live in New London, Wisconsin, and there's a large Latino population in the city. Rachel says there are multiple businesses that are Latino-owned, including restaurants, and the city's only bakery features traditional sweets and breads. And Rachel enjoys the culture that they bring to the community. Feels good to live in a place that is accepting and welcomes diversity. How do you feel about those sentiments?
I mean, that's exactly what we want Wisconsinites to understand, right? And I appreciate this message is coming in from New London, out of Gaymere Wolpaca. You know, it's an area that perhaps Wisconsinites might not realize has a large Latino population. And in the book, what I'm trying to do is to show that these communities have existed in places like Outagamie and Wapaka for quite a long time. Then perhaps they have been migrant farm workers occupying these spaces for a limited time, coming in the spring and leaving in the harvest season, or perhaps they're now lifelong residents like they are all across urban and rural spaces in Wisconsin. And I think the important thing for our state residents to really grapple with is, what does it mean to be a good neighbor? What are the boundaries of being a good neighbor? In other words, do we just say hello to someone, or do we welcome them into our spaces and consider them full members of our communities? So I really appreciate that sentiment.
So taking us into that mid-20th century, migrant farm workers, you write, are among the most economically disadvantaged and socially alienated populations in the country. What is happening in this time in Wisconsin?
Yeah, you know, the state after World War II is a booming agricultural site. It is actually the number one canning state in the entire United States. So it's producing so much produce that is really feeding not just the country, but the world. But with such accelerating economic production, it needs workers to do the work. And the place that farmers look to fill these needs is the U.S.-Mexico borderlands. And they look towards Texas Mexicans, American citizens who refer to themselves as Tejanos, to come up here every spring to help plant the produce and then to actually pick them all the way through the early fall. And so in the 1950s, about 15,000 Texas Mexicans are making their way to Wisconsin, and they come up as family units because if you can walk, if you can pick, the expectation is you're helping the family provide that important income that they need for the entire year. Unfortunately, even though they are essential to the state's agricultural industry, they are often perceived as nothing more than just workers. And so they have some really rough working conditions, rough pay conditions. And then when they try to move into social spaces, whether that's the local beaches, whether that's restaurants in towns across Wisconsin, they're often met with a cold shoulder.
And in the workforce housing, you then see Catholics and Protestants coming to the fields and talking to the migrant laborers. Can you explain the tensions there and what the religious groups are trying to do?
You know, this is a really awkward moment, I would say, for telling this history, because the Catholics and Protestants, what they refer to themselves as migrant ministers, they go out into the fields with the stated intention of serving these people who are functionally seen as outcasts in many of the communities that they inhabit. But oftentimes what that outreach turns into is less a form of full hospitality and instead competition over the attendance of these Mexican migrants in their churches. There's this one example here that I draw out in the book. The Wisconsin Council of Churches sends their migrant ministers out into the fields, and they send them out in a specific type of car. It's a station wagon that's equipped with everything they need to conduct, religious services out in the middle of a field. And these station wagons are emblazoned on the side with a word. It says the harvester. And of course, it's kind of a play on words. They are working with harvesters in the fields, but these migrant ministers are also serving as harvesters of souls. They're trying to make sure they can maybe get some converts to the Protestant faith. And so there's a real competition between Catholics and Protestants, not to better serve these migrants, but functionally to make sure that they become members of their churches.
And this is how you say this is a conditional type of hospitality. There is, you convert and then we perhaps will give you further support. Was there support being given to these laborers?
Yeah, I mean, it's a conditional hospitality that exists within these church spaces, right? I will offer you support. I will offer you welcome into the state if you convert to the faith or if you are a willing attending of church. But it's also a conditional hospitality that exists all across the state of Wisconsin outside of church spaces. It's, you know, we will welcome these migrants as long as they provide us some sort of economic service. And so this is a form of conditional hospitality because it's a form of welcome that's dependent on the economic utility that these individuals can offer to the state of Wisconsin. Through the 1950s, migrant farm workers really struggled to find a place in the state. And it's made extra difficult, of course, by the fact that they're only here from April through September or October. And then they have to migrate back to the U.S.-Mexico borderlands where they live in the off season. And so throughout the 1950s, they don't have a lot of resources to kind of create solid spaces in the state where they feel like they completely belong.
Sergio Gonzalez with us as we look at the history of Latinos in Wisconsin, 1900s, author of the new book, Strangers No Longer. You can join the conversation at any point, call in with a question, share your perspective at 800-642-1234. Sergio, let's look now to Puerto Ricans who migrate to Wisconsin by the thousands after World War II. And you found churches received Puerto Ricans differently than they had Mexican migrants. How are the two groups treated differently?
Yeah, well, in some ways, they're treated very differently, even though they share, you know, linguistic background. And some of the churches do see them in a similar light to the Mexicans in that they are, you know, Latin American arrivals to the space. But Puerto Ricans begin arriving in Milwaukee. They're also recruited here as industrial laborers after World War II. And they find a very different reception than the Mexican Catholics had received before them. Puerto Rican Catholics have kind of shuttled into a very different form of hospitality. It's one that's based really around the question of assimilation. The Catholic Church as a national institution, right, archdioceses around the country are beginning to move away from this idea of allowing immigrants to retain their ethnic heritage and specifically their linguistic identity. And what they're trying to do is to really shuttle newcomers into a larger American Catholic Church. They want these people who are arriving in the United States to be kind of be perceived as full members of an American Catholicism. And so what that means for Puerto Ricans, who of course are American citizens when they arrive here, is that they are forced into English classes. Their use of Spanish priests is kind of seen as temporary so that they can be shuttled eventually into a larger parish structure. And so perhaps the intention is good in that the hope is that they will integrate into the community, but the reality is that they're being forced to do so at the extent or kind of at the loss of what they may hold to be dear to their identity as Puerto Ricans, as Puerto Rican Catholics.
Can you speak to how the Frank Seidler, the mayor of Milwaukee in those years, you know, serving three terms starting in 48, how did Seidler treat Puerto Ricans in Milwaukee?
You know, Seidler views Puerto Ricans in the same way that many Milwaukeeans view Puerto Ricans, and that is as racial others, as strangers that kind of exist at the edges of the community. As in-migrants that have to be assimilated to the community, perhaps under ways that are not necessarily inviting, that again require them to give up something of themselves. And so, unfortunately, the archives don't paint the Seidler administration in a very positive light. They kind of talk about these cultural deficiencies that exist among Puerto Ricans, talk about kind of the limits to which they might be actually be able to be included into the larger American body. And in some ways, they kind of parrot a lot of what's happening in the city streets in the northeast side where a lot of Puerto Ricans are settling, and also in some of the city's Catholic and Protestant churches. And so, again, this is kind of a persistent issue throughout the 1950s, viewing these people as newcomers who may or may not be able to integrate into the community because of their language, because of their skin color, because of who they are.
Ellen in Cedarburg called in and is wondering if you could address the racism aspect in this conversation and what you learned in your research.
Oh, goodness. Yeah, that's unfortunately, that's a consistent thread when talking about Latino settlement in Wisconsin. And we can talk about racism. We can talk about colorism, right? The fact that a Latino skin color can also change the way in which they're viewed by Wisconsinites. And there's also, of course, the question of where Latinos fit within what I think is a very persistent binary all across the Midwest, which is a white-Black racial binary. It's a way that we kind of view the world within these two worlds. Historians of the Midwest often talk about Latinos in the Midwest as being in between people because they arrive in the 1920s after a lot of Wisconsinites and Wisconsin institutions have established this kind of racial understanding of a Black and white world, and Latinos don't fit neatly into that narrative. And I think we kind of see that to this day. We're still kind of troubling with that, whether that's in the U.S. Census, whether that's in questions of affirmative action, whether that's in the way in which Latinos relate to different institutions. And of course, racism, which is the inaction kind of discrimination based on a person's perceived race, is also a part of that story.
Marquette University historian Sergio Gonzalez examining how Wisconsin Latinos have struggled with feelings of being strangers in their communities, not accepted. The book is called Strangers No Longer. Call in with a question. You can share comments at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with Marquette University historian Sergio Gonzalez, who shows how some Wisconsin churches became vocal advocates for the rights of Latino immigrants and refugees. And we trace this movement, especially in Milwaukee. You can join the discussion. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Larry in Kingston is here. Larry, go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to ask you about the restaurants in Milwaukee. Last time I drove through Milwaukee, the Acapulco restaurant and the Cancun restaurant, I couldn't find either one. And they were so good in the early 70s. I was wondering if you're familiar with them.
Larry, thank you. Can you speak about the longtime established businesses and what's become of them, Sergio?
Yeah, thanks for that question, Larry. Yeah, of course, those are great Southside institutions. Unfortunately, they have both closed up. The Acapulco, I remember that growing up, off the National in Walker's Point. It's the history of a lot of immigrant communities in Wisconsin. It's turning to food as a place of making home. It's a place to connect different communities that are thousands of miles removed from the places that they really miss. But it's also, of course, a way of inviting the local residents into your own culture. And so Mexican restaurants, Puerto Rican restaurants, and now Central American restaurants all across Milwaukee, across Wisconsin, can often serve as that gateway, as we can kind of see in this conversation, a way of connecting with this community. And the thing that I would hope is that those restaurants are kind of first steps and not just last steps for Wisconsinites to learn more about Latinos in the state.
Richard from Madison called and mentioned that they worked at the Green Giant Canning Company in Beaver Dam between 1974 and 75. And in that time, migrant workers came through as well. Richard says they weren't treated well as they lived in trailers, had to work different shifts. But my father made close friends, Richard says, with a worker and then their family. Can you talk about those connections at all as to what that type of hospitality would bring?
Yeah, I appreciate that comment from Richard. You know, I think it really speaks to the distinctions between institutions, employers, and individuals, right? I mean, we have to kind of look at this at a lot of different levels. Even though migrant farm workers may have experienced really bad working conditions all across the 20th century and the agricultural industry and perhaps they had antagonistic relationships with their bosses, that doesn't preclude them from making individual relationships with local Wisconsinites. And it really does speak to the importance of individual initiative, right? The agency we all have to begin to kind of disrupt these larger 100-long histories of these false senses of hospitality, that we can extend a welcoming hand to somebody and get to know someone as an individual, as someone we work with, as someone who can be a constitutive member of our communities. And so I'm really glad for that comment.
You write about a group of kids who called themselves the Thunderbirds. And in the 60s, they convert this tavern into a social hangout. It was the Spot. Can you tell us about that moment in history?
Yeah, this is, you know, the Spot is formed as a Protestant outreach center on the city's south side of Milwaukee towards the city's growing Mexican and Mexican-American Puerto Rican youth, trying to get kids off the streets from doing dumb things and giving an outlet for them to do something more productive. But the kids, they take the initiative and transform this. They turn what used to be a street gang called the Thunderbirds into a productive social agency, which eventually becomes the Spot, which today is known with a very different name here in Milwaukee, the United Community Center. Mm. It is a central hub of Latino life on the city's south side. It really offers everything from prenatal care all the way to senior care. I mean, so it's amazing to think about how this institution that is central to Milwaukee's Latino community began both as a place of religious outreach, but also as a place of initiative by youth on the city's south side.
And in this time, El Centro Hispano is formed, the first nonprofit Latino organization. What is that milestone like?
Well, it's really important because it's a recognition by the Catholic Church here in Milwaukee that they have to move beyond just opening parish spaces for Latinos. And they're recognizing that on the city's south side, there's a growing need to provide educational services, work services, integration experiences for Latinos. And they really put the money where their mouth is. They make sure that there are actually resources available. And as I kind of track in the book, the history of Centro Hispano, which becomes a Spanish center, the United Community Center, and also United Migrant Opportunities Services, are stories of, you know, religious institutions creating these spaces, and then Latinos deciding that they have to actually take over these agencies to have full control of them, mm-hmm. for them to actually represent the needs of the community.
Take us into the sanctuary movement. Now we go into the 1980s, the movement seeking to provide refuge for Central American asylum seekers. How critical are religious organizations for that movement in that time?
I think listeners might be surprised to learn that Milwaukee was a central hub of sanctuary organizing in the 1980s. Churches and synagogues here in Milwaukee opened up their houses of worship as places of safe harbor for the hundreds of thousands of Central Americans who were fleeing persecution and civil war in their home countries. You know, these civil wars in places like Guatemala and El Salvador killed 250,000 people, forced the migration of more than 2 million others northward. And the United States government in the 1980s refused to recognize them as political asylees because they'd also have to recognize the military's role in destabilizing those countries. And so it was really churches and synagogues all across the United States that became places of asylum, temporary asylum for these people. Milwaukee had the first Latino, the first Black, and the first Jewish congregations that opened up their places as houses of sanctuary in the 1980s. I mean, it's kind of phenomenal to think that Milwaukee was such an important spot for this. And of course, sanctuary today in the 21st century is a really polarizing term. It's a politically fraught term. But in the 1980s, what it actually meant was extending a sense of hospitality to those who needed it most.
And at the pulpit, there are the testimonials that, you know, Central Americans telling their stories to congregations, what they have experienced. Did that change public opinion on asylum seekers?
No, it certainly did. You know, the sanctuary movement had a lot of different angles. One was, of course, that humanitarian aid, but the other was really to alert Americans of our country's complicity in destabilizing nations down in Central America. And the primary purveyors of that educational work were really the Central Americans themselves, who would go to different churches all across Milwaukee and all across Wisconsin, actually, telling their heart-wrenching stories of violence, of persecution, of death, and really imploring Wisconsinites to step forward and to push their legislators to stop sending military aid to Central America, to recognize that they had an obligation not just to offer safe harbor to these people, but to try to fix the very conditions that were forcing them to leave from their home countries in the first place.
further to these times, then there's the new sanctuary movement. What occurred when former President Trump was elected?
You know, the new sanctuary movement first arose in the early 2000s as a response to a accelerating deportation machine under Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama. But after the election of President Trump in 2016, religious congregations across the United States recognized that there was a need to not just accelerate the sanctuary movement, but to grow it on an astronomical level. And so the sanctuary movement had been bubbling before 2016, and beginning in early 2017, we saw congregations all across the United States once again kind of renew that pledge to be places of radical hospitality for those people who were fleeing or were afraid of detention, deportation. The difference between the 1980s movement, of course, is that many of the people who were walking into churches, into synagogues, were people who had called the United States home for many years. And so they were looking not just for safe harbor, but they were looking for a recognition that they were constitutive members of their communities. They were full neighbors in what it means to be the United States.
In our final moments together, how could people in Wisconsin provide better hospitality to immigrants moving here?
Well, I think it comes on many different levels. One is to disrupt this narrative that they are only newcomers and that they are foreigners who will only reside within the boundaries of our state for a limited time. We have to think of them as our potential future neighbors and think about all of the obligations that come along with that, not just being nice to someone, hospitable to someone, but thinking about what that means in terms of extending political, social, and economic power to these individuals as well. There are all of these different sites in which we can do that type of work. It's not just, of course, religious spaces, but we have to think about our obligations in terms of civic organizations, legislators, what they can do at the state level, not the local level, to adjust our laws to make sure that we have the full capacity to welcome people into the state of Wisconsin. So there's a lot that we can do.
Sergio, thank you for joining us and sharing your book.
Thank you, Kate. I really appreciate it.
Sergio Gonzalez, assistant professor in the Department of History at Marquette University. The book is called Strangers No Longer, Latino Belonging and Faith in 20th Century Wisconsin. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.